Say right now, the data that's historically behind the four walls of utilities companies, energy developers, electricity providers, that's a gold mine. Because in the past, because of a very centralized grid system, you have a equally centralized IT and also tech stack that surrounds it and optimized for it. Everything is built towards surrounding around your one big nuclear reactor or like one big coal power plant and satisfying that. So the data infrastructure is built to be in-house first. But now that's going to be completely changing, where you have thousands, if not millions, of entry points into the grid. Anything from like your heat pumps at home, or your VPP that you use in your local community, or the charger, right?
Welcome back to the Clean Techies Podcast, where we interview the top climate founders and VCs to get their best advice for you. In this episode, I chat with Peter Sun, founding team at Climactic, an early stage fund investing in climate tech, specifically focused on efficiency and software, which has a lot to do with, you guessed it, AI. We dive into the nuances of how AI is impacting climate tech, where the opportunities are for software in decarbonization, and Peter's journey joining the founding team. As someone who personally is wary of putting AI in every conversation, Peter had real insight into the ins and outs of what's real and what's not, and I really enjoyed learning from him. As always, thanks so much for listening, and enjoy the episode. A quick note before we dive in, the audio quality of this episode was unfortunately a bit echoey, so we really appreciate your patience, and we'll have it better for next time. Anyway, let's dive in. All right, welcome to the show, Peter. How are you?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Doing well. We're recording this on MLK Day, so appreciate you taking the time out of your holiday for this. We were talking with Peter before this. The weather today has been not fantastic. There's been some snow warnings and stuff like that, so it really messed up some travel.
That's right. So,
thank you, Peter, for being flexible.
Yeah, no worries at all. It looks like you are safe and warm, and that's all I can hope for.
Yeah. All right. Well, why don't we get into it? Can you please tell us who you are?
Sure. So, long story short, I'm Peter. I'm Chinese Australian. I love building things from scratch. I care about enduring changes that make financial sense. I believe in decarbonization being one of the biggest opportunities we'll see in our lifetime. So now I'm on the founding team of Climactic.
Hey there. Are you building a climate tech business and looking for very specialized talent? Consider reaching out to our sponsors, NextWave Partners. NextWave are experts in talent acquisition, recruitment, and retention across the climate tech, renewables, and ESG spaces globally. So if your team is growing or you're looking to make a career change yourself, feel free to reach out to NextWave at next-wavepartners.com or reach out to one of their consultants directly via their LinkedIn page.
Amazingly vague. Why don't we get into it? So can you tell us a little about Climactic?
Sure. So, and now I'm going to get very specific because this is what I tell my founders when I meet them. So Climactic is a $65 million fund. Early stage, we focus on climate tech, but what we really mean by that is we focus on four underlying sectors. There's energy, there's mobility, there's a supply chain, and lastly, the built environment. And in terms of the investment appetite, we focus on early stage startups like, pre-seed through to Series A, usually B2B software or software plus hardware solutions within climate, and the team is really small, just a thrill of us, small and nimble.
You can often be seen posting about AI and climate, but I think it's pretty much worth pointing out that I don't think that actually represents exactly what you guys do. Can you dive into that a little bit?
I mean, yes and no, depending how you want to look at it, right? So these days, everyone seems to be an AI investor, but I do believe that climate, especially energy, does have a very special edge when it comes to AI. So let's take a step back. Like, I would think about AI not as the defining thing of what we do, but rather a good representation of it. What that means is we invest in effective and efficient scaling, right? In what sense? In the sense of that we live in a world where resources are constrained. We can't just have nuclear fusion just like that. So we have to work with limited things while minimizing pollution, emissions, and other negative impacts, right, on the overall society. And I just think AI is a very big part of that going forward, along with a lot of other things we invest in, such as a cleaner renewable grid, smart supply chain software, new ways of doing manufacturing, anything from like robotics to workflow automation, or other ways to manage our aging, build well as well.
You teased it a little bit, but I want to get into what it actually means to be looking at AI and climate. What are the common applications that you are bullish on when it comes to seeing data, artificial intelligence, all these things applied in climate companies?
Yeah, so I think you mentioned that you saw some of my LinkedIn posts. So like, I'm feeling very guilty because I'm going to read one of my LinkedIn posts out to you verbatim. No, I'm just kidding. But this is a good example I made a little while ago. So people ask about, for example, LLM, the hottest babe we have in the AI world right now. What does that have anything to do with, you know, the rest of climate? So let's take a very specific example of, solar installation, right, in the residential world. People think it's all just about, you know, putting solar panels together and whatnot. But a lot of these workflows, right, can be automated and be addressed by AI. Like anything from the start of the sales process, right, specialized automated SDR, where, you know, it's more difficult than just having one sales call with your client to know what kind of panel or what angle on what roofing to put on. By using LLM in processing, right, you know, multimedia sources provided by your client, anything from a blueprint to the actual customer call, you're able to shorten all these like processes that have everything to do with having the right asset on your client's roof, but nothing to do with the actual billable hours of an experienced contractor who knows everything about installing the panel. Think about how many hours you can save and how many of those hours can be put into this country's renewable, you know, revolution.
The specific use case there, I think, is, like you mentioned, efficiency, automation, things like that. A lot of the times, I think people think about automation in terms of software, but there's, I think, a more promising vertical popping up in setting up hardware infrastructure that generates data points that's useful in AI. Could you talk a little bit about if at all you're bullish and seeing things and ways that people are using AI and hardware applications? Because I think that's especially important in climate.
And that's exactly why climate is different. I'm all, you know, open to talk about why AI founders should get into climate. But to answer your question, it's actually a yes and no, Samuel. Because yes, in the sense that, yes, you know, sensors and like remote sensing can have a lot of applications giving new data points. One specific example is in wind energy, right? Offshore wind energy is so hard to access and monitor and to, you know, maintain and do auto operations around it. But by having sensors, right, one can even optimize these like turbines to be at the exact angle, right, 5 seconds before the right wing is going to hit. And these small things really add up. We are talking about like 10-20% of efficiency improvement. And this amount of data can never be processed, right, without the latest state-of-art AI applications we have. But on the flip side, it also works. How to use AI to avoid, right, overspending on the hardware, overspending on infrastructure build up. Because as I said, right, we function in the world with constrained resources, money being one of them. And given how much energy transition we need to make, we need to spend very carefully about which part of the infrastructure we need to build to enable green energy transition. And by using AI in things like, you know, load optimization, vehicle to grid, you know, interactions, you can actually save a big handsome sum of money not building part of the grid while still delivering the green energy that, you know, you want to deliver. And one of our portfolio companies, WithGrid, is a very good example in doing that.
Hey guys, sorry for the interruption. I just need a few seconds because Soma and I have two quick favors to ask. Putting out the show each week takes about 15 to 20 hours between us, so it's a lot of effort. And it would mean the world to us if you would leave a review and mention your favorite episode. Secondly, if you're not already, go over and subscribe to the podcast on Substack. The content is free, but if you like hanging out with us each week, maybe we're even the kind of guys you'd like to buy a coffee for on occasion, consider becoming a paid subscriber. For the cost of one lavender latte a month, you can help us immensely. Thank you for tuning in consistently and helping us to share our guests' stories. Now back to the show.
Yeah, I appreciate you shouting that out. I was just about to dive into it. I think WeaveGrid is especially exciting because I work at Elemental. They're an Elemental accelerator portfolio company as well.
Great place to be, yes.
Yeah, and I think they are sort of the same class of like, you know, Series B plus level company that's doing really great work in electrifying the grid. They were some of the first people to really get there in you know, clean tech 2.0. So I'd love to dive into them. Just tell us about the story of WeaveGrid and you know, what you saw in them.
Well, WeaveGrid is actually, gosh, this is down the memory lane. We invested in them like at least 1 or 2 years ago. That's when we were just doing angel investing together, the three of us. And I think it was pretty interesting, both for the founder and for what are they doing, right? Remember, 2-3 years ago, we're in the middle of COVID. And one of the big slogan, what was it? Flatten the curve, right? And that's how we were able to avoid, you know, building up new hospitals and like respirators, all these expensive stuff while still saving people. Imagine doing that for energy, right? Flatten the curve of new demands from EVs, heat pumps, or other appliances by making a dynamic grid, integrating these assets with batteries, and then with a power grid to optimize charging, discharging, and you know, grid performance. It's a very neat idea and definitely very refreshing. Then you pair that up with Apoorv, the founder, right? Who came out of BCG, got consulting background, but also so deep, right, in energy. And this is not just the consulting side of me cheating. It's also very interesting having such a hybrid profile, right, of someone who knows how to talk the business talk, but also talk the technical talk while presenting themselves in front of, you know, Silicon Valley investors and knowing the software stack. So all these things don't come together easily. And in that case, that's definitely something that touched all of my team.
I want to ask really quickly about that. It's interesting because you see a lot of different AI companies who are, you know, have super high run rates, but I think it's a brand new marketplace. OpenAI just released their brand new marketplace. There's a lot of innovation still going on in the market. Product market fit is really interesting. I think as difficult as it is in hardware to really know if you've achieved product market fit, I think it's also equally as different to know that for AI, because these large enterprise contracts are often muddled, especially on the utility side. There's a lot of infrastructure that has to get built up for energy companies and different buildings to even care about data and AI. One thing I want to ask you is, in the companies that are evaluating, especially since you're looking at the early stage, how do you find product market fit and what are the signals of companies that will hop off the bandwagon right now, not just AI, but in terms of automation and efficiency? What does that really look like in climate tech today?
Right. Now, that's a great question. And I think like I think about this as much as a lot of the AI founders do for sure. And I think in the very beginning, right, there's two parts of it. There's urgency, right, and there's significance. So in climate, you see a lot of things that are very significant potentially, but the urgency varies across the board, right? Just because we need to have like a grid that supports renewables and how renewables behave doesn't mean this have to be. Everything has to be done, right? Right now, in this year, or in the next three years. Then it comes to who decides how urgent something is for that product market fit, right? Then the next thing to do is to get into these utilities and like power companies and understanding who's making the decision. And there are three types of people, and in this sequence, that I find useful in terms of sequencing the opportunities I pursue. First, there's people who can no longer do their job without bring the tech stack forward. Then there's people who can unlock new revenue and like, you know, upside opportunities by using AI or other tech innovations. Lastly, there's people who can incrementally do their jobs better or stay competitive using this new tech, right? So I usually focus on the first bunch of people. And the examples down that track would be, you know, people who's right now working on what I would call unclustering the cluster studies when it comes to building and planning the transmission lines, or dealing with the dynamic power loads, right? Like when it comes to renewable assets, or people who's trying to bring EV chargers and energy management into aging building environments, such as a lot of the multifamily units that's craving for EV chargers. Like these people need to really adopt and think about new tech to use. Otherwise their job is at jeopardy in a lot of times, like when it comes to new energy. But yeah, happy to go deeper.
No, that's super interesting. You talked about a juxtaposition actually that I think I would love to dive into. But just to make sure I understand, you're really focusing on the people who, without technology, without this technology, can't compete with, what is the alternative? Is it other companies that are developing technology faster?
Well, no, I think that you can't compete, but that's actually would be the third group of people that I'll be going after in the sequence of opportunities I would chase for. But the first one right now today, I will go for people who's already overwhelmed using the existing tech stack.
One interesting fact here. So we had Jay Kapoor from VSC Ventures on. They're also very much into industrial automation. And I think the topic of job replacement versus augmentation is a big like topic of conversation when it comes to automation. In your experience, when you're looking at people whose tech stacks are not developed enough or lack those capabilities, mm-hmm. how are you evaluating those people? Are you evaluating whether you can automate those jobs, augment them? I know you said you focus on the first, but how do you think about, you know, speaking relatively curtly, job loss when it comes to evaluating these technologies?
Right. I think that's, again, a very interesting thing when it comes to energy or just, you know, climate tech. I don't think we can afford a lot of times automation taking over the job. In fact, it's more like we already don't have enough trained labor force and skilled workers. And even with automation in the mix, it's not about replacing, it's about empowering, right? So I'll give you two examples real quick. So one, let's take up the transmission cluster study thing that I was talking about. Currently, the queue in California or in even more deregulated markets like Australia, we are talking about like years of wait to bring new, you know, solar farms online because people are doing, you know, studies on where to build a transmission line. So, where to optimize the sites. And that's the thing that's like, that's a problem that only recently got very acute because in the past, you don't have to bring this many power assets online this quickly. So, and then there's just not that many experts in the space as electrical engineers to like deal with it. So if you roll automation into like modeling scenarios and, you know, ML to like do decision trees and things like that, you don't need to replace anyone in the big power companies. You're just enhancing them. So now they can take this on and do it. So that's one example. Mm-hmm.
That's super interesting. I think one thing sorry to cut you off there, but I'd love to dive into one of that points, which is transmission lines are incredibly important to the grid, but also notoriously difficult to develop. In your experience, why are they so difficult to implement?
Well, I can only talk about this as from a VC investor perspective. I can't replace all the real power experts on the line, but I guess dealing with hypothetical assets right now is the hard part because when you build these assets, they're going to be there for like decades to come. When we really hope you build these assets at where there's going to be more and more generators coming online, right? So you want to have this like dynamic sort of like modeling, right? Like transmission line builders want to know where the new generators will be. Generator builders will make their decisions based on where the lines will be. In the past, it was easier because there's just not that many centralized big power plants getting online. These days, that proliferated like crazy. Australia, my home country, as an example, up to 2017-18, we're talking about 2 or 3 power plants per year. Right now, that's 200. So imagine using software or automation tools you had in-house to deal with like 3 moving variables. Now apply that to dealing with 200 variables. I think, man, like I'm very sympathetic towards the folks that's like, you know, on the front line there. It's not an easy job.
So just to make sure I understand, it's sort of a market chaos dynamic where there's so much activity and it's so chaotic, it's hard to predict what are the most optimal places to put transmission lines. Am I understanding that?
To some extent, yes. And I think what's really interesting about this and why AI is relevant is this is not just a business, model problem. It's not just, renewable energy. It's a math problem. Because it's a classic, multi-scenario optimization problem that you have so many moving variables and you have to run so many, cases.
Hey guys, we need your help with something. In order to better understand what you like most about the show, what you dislike, and how we can help you, please take 7 minutes to fill out our listener survey if you haven't already. It only takes about 7 minutes, but it will drastically improve our ability to give you the best content that you're looking for. Thanks for your help. Now back to the show.
Let's get into one facet of this, which is you need data and you need information to be able to do this prediction, right? And I'm sure that's incredibly difficult to come across. Let's talk about data assets and climate. So what, as an investor, are you really excited by when it comes to we have this data, we can use it this way? What excites you when you're looking at like different proprietary data sets? And to whatever extent you can say, depending on what's in your pipeline right now, what data, especially when it comes to energy and automation in general, do you think is the most valuable in the next, call it 5 to 10 years?
That's a very fascinating question. I would say right now, the data that's, historically behind the four walls of utilities companies, energy developers, electricity providers, that's a gold mine. Because in the past, because of a very centralized grid system, you have an equally centralized IT and also tech stack that surrounds it and optimizes for it. Everything is built towards surrounding around, you know, your one big nuclear reactor or like one big coal power plant and satisfying that. So the data, right, the data infrastructure is built to be in-house first. But now that's going to be completely changing, where you have thousands, if not millions, of entry points into the grid. Anything from like your heat pumps at home, or your VPP that you use in your local community, or the charger, right? These power companies have to open their walls to let other people share and use the data for their own sake of keeping the grid, like safe during ever more dynamic behaviors, right, of these power assets. And suddenly you're starting to wonder, does this start to look like the deregulation of telecom, right, in the 80s and 90s, which, after which you have a lot of data that's being shared with like startups, internet companies, and other folks to launch new products, new services, and more data analytics. Not to say that that deregulation is right here, right now, but it starts to give us hope that it might go down that track.
So you mentioned keep the grid safe. What does that mean in this context?
How do you keep, in 20, 30 years, the biggest ecosystem of both hardware and software, all of it with electricity that might kill people or black out a whole community or factory, while opening up the whole system to thousands of users that directly plugging their EVs into it? Cybersecurity, load management, all of it rolled together is where we talk about, I guess, operational and critical situation safety of the whole system.
So the real solution potentially that we've seen, just to understand the parallel that you're making, is that the unraveling and deregulation of the telecom industry eventually served to its benefit in terms of the longevity of its services. And in terms of grid infrastructure, because it's so chaotic, it actually benefits the grid utility managers to be able to build an ecosystem around this. And it probably won't scale fast enough to do this privately. So if they open it, it will likely build to like a much more robust energy system that they can then profit off. Is that accurate?
I think so. And I'm starting to even wonder, to push it even further, who gets to make that decision anyways? Back in the 80s, it wasn't the telecom folks that actually made a decision to open that. It was regulators, it was other competitors in the market, and new tech providers like the internet companies, right? So we might face the same thing here. Obviously, not to dismiss how important and critical the utilities and energy companies are when it comes to managing the grid for the past two centuries. It's just if the complexity of the grid is going to go up by exponentially, we would need new players in the field to make sure we collectively run an efficient grid.
Is tracking legislation a big part of your due diligence process?
It's something that we want to be better. And I think this is Achilles heel, right, when it comes to running a small VC fund. But we have partners, venture partners and also collaborators in the field who is more well-versed when it comes to legal stuff.
Do you think that climate VC as a whole, you just sort of climactic, everything's super exciting. What were the real opportunities you saw being a climate VC, right? I want to kind of do a hard pivot into that, because now we're talking about fund structure. You started off as a climate VC. In some of our conversations, we've talked about what that comes with, some of how that affects your experience in terms of fundraising and going out to companies. Just talk about what it's like being a quote-unquote climate VC in today's market.
It's an interesting thing, because that's how it started, and we are also thinking about this concept as we evolve. But to answer the question, so when we pitched to LPs back in the days, I think it was either slide 4 or 5, we have this one big slogan that's just in the middle of the slide that says, decarbonization is the new digitalization. And I think why that really matters is not often do you come across systemic innovation or upgrade of a whole ecosystem across different industries, across different sectors. Digitalization was one. Started in telecom, then went through the rest of everything that we know that's called the internet today, right? And we see the same scale and also the same pathway when it comes to climate tech, right? In the sense that if the economy continues to decarbonize, right, it's not only just about doing good and like save the world. In fact, the world doesn't need us to save, we're merely saving ourselves as humans. It's about national energy security. It's about running a robust supply chain. It's about, you know, renewing how we consume and interact with energy, like Edison did back, you know, like in the, you know, 1800s, right? And there's also a long runway that really excites me as well. Think about the internet again. Telecom was the first step. Then you have the dot-com companies, right? Then you have mobile. Then you have like industry applications, da-da-da-da-da. Same thing we see in climate tech as well. First, you have things that's like, you know, carbon accounting, right? There's carbon credits, things like that. Then you move on to energy software, like we are looking at today. Then you're starting to look at other parts of tech that's bridging into energy, such as AI. Then moving onwards at, you know, there might be other things that might be happening when we have a whole fleet of like renewable energy assets, when we have a whole fleet of heat pumps in our commercial buildings, a whole fleet of automation in our factories, right? So I like this theme of like software will push hardware going forward and accelerate that. And then when you have like, you know, meaningfully more hardware, that unlocks new opportunities for software folks to jump on. And that sort of like feedback loop, I hope, is going to work on these two legs. And that's what really excites me. Yeah.
You ended that perfectly, because the question that I had was software. One of the big things about climbing VC is that it's trying to emulate regular VC, you know, traditional VC in a way. And one of the big criticisms, and I think this comes from like a lot of normal climate capital stack conversations, is that VC was uniquely fitted to the growth of software, where you had large amounts of untapped markets now coming online because of digitization. You're oftentimes investing in technology that is more deep tech or hardware oriented or hard tech oriented. That usually means you have larger upfront R&D costs that slow the growth of sort of like, you know, your exponential, you know, traditional revenue growth model that a VC aims for. So let's say I'm one of these, you know, very successful, very well off traditional VCs who is super confused by climate tech. And I bring up this point about hardware being slower than software. If you've, you know, what is your response to that? And like, does that conversation happen often?
Gosh, it happens so often that if you call me with this question last year, last summer, I will have tell you about, you know, my existential crisis over exactly this question over a beer. Yes, it's a big question. And that's frankly why CleanTech 1.0 failed, because a lot of VC used, you know, money that raised from their LPs expecting software patents, threw them at solar panels, which unfortunately was not software. And once China came into the field and cut down the cost by 80%, it was very tough to compete, right? So that's part of the story why it failed back then. And what's different this time is VCs can be either or both. You have VC funds like Breakthrough that's doing great work when it comes to very deep tech stuff. This is like, you know, nuclear fusion, not even solar panels, but nuclear fusions, next generation biomed, you know, stuff and things like that, right? Then in the middle, you are having venture funds that also have a debt arm, people who have a debt facility who come in investing things as software plus hardware, like, you know, charging network, things like that, right? And they can finance both ways, work with two legs. Then you have folks, lastly, like us, who come in knowing our forte is at software. We came from the software world, that's what we're familiar with. And we focus specifically on software opportunities that's riding on existing trends of hardware and infrastructure build up. So I will probably likely not going to touch nuclear fusion upfront. I will probably work with someone when it comes to a software plus hardware play that has a debt facility. And I will focus on software applications on existing trends that, you know, like the infrastructure has already been picking up in the past 5-10 years. So you have a full cap stack that's in, you know, in swing in climate tech. And I think that's very different than what we had in the past. And, you know,
I think, so you're pointing out one of the main catalysts is the existence of debt, you know, venture debt arms. These are models that are better suited for when you have assets available. And that's oftentimes what's the case in climate tech. The thing that I find interesting about climate is whether people are willing to invest at later stages, depending on how much capital they've reinvested. So that happens to be like venture debt is not necessarily the type of investment that promotes like, you know, exponential growth scaling the same exact way that traditional VC did. And that's some of the pushback that I get across, which is, yes, you raised venture debt, but it's not the same confidence. It doesn't induce the same amount of confidence as a traditional VC investment. And I think that's why you hear the ethos of raise from a traditional VC, not a climate VC, to prove that your company is good. So if you've ever come across that statement, how do you console a founder who's been told that, but they approach you being like, but you're a climate VC?
Because we're people who came out of traditional and general VC just happen to be focused on climate. I think there's also a very relevant question, which is climate VC versus impact VC, right? These are concepts plus ESG all being thrown together into one big pot and being cooked and, you know, like that and labeled being different, right, than traditional and general tech VC. So I think that's something that's also worth thinking. I think in the past, you know, impact VC was super important in the ecosystem when there was just a, you know, blank between clean tech 1.0 and today's wave of climate tech. But these days, we are seeing a lot of companies like the ones that we're just talking about that have imminent impact, right? Doing good work at scale on the ground right now in energy and other fields that we believe as a VC fund that we can find things that can return just like other investments in the general tech space. But also at the same time, a lot of climate founders come from more varied and diverse backgrounds, right, than just in traditional VC focus on software for other software companies. So they do benefit from having a VC fund that came out of the software world, but also speak their language. Our value comes exactly being at that bridge. And when it comes to like their next fundraising round, our network in the general tech VC side will probably be very helpful, right? Solving that question when it comes to the next round. And we have been doing that in the past when it comes to, you know, the portfolio companies we have. A lot of our companies raise money from general tech VC funds in their later rounds as well.
At the stage that you invest in, what was the biggest difference for you, the three of you coming from a more traditional background, now in climate, what was the biggest difference in your diligence process in evaluating companies going from that to a climate context?
That's also a very good question. I think the answer here lies in where we spend time learning. Climate is a theme, not a sector, right? And we cover so many things. And energy, even though we've been talking about it so much, it's only one of it. And each diligence brings a different niche in a different vertical, in a different sector. And we find ourselves spending a lot of time, right, studying not just the software and tech stack, but the industry context, the buyer sentiment, the product market fit, what's the incumbent, all these questions that feels even closer to what I used to do at Bain, doing, you know, multi-industry diligence than what I've seen in my peers in general tech VC. So, I mean, if I can use this time as like a promo time, I would love to get in touch with more people working in these industries, like actual industry experts who've been there for 20, 30 years, join force with us and like learn together. And that's a unique, I would say, unique challenge and also opportunity for us.
Where do you think most industry veterans are coming from? So a lot of times people come into climate having experience in another industry. We had on one of the co-founders of Casper, who's now building a climate tech company, so quite a different background there. Casper is the sleep company, the mattress company. But where do you see a lot of industry founders coming from? Which industries in specific?
Yeah, I think, gosh, as I said before, it's very diverse, right? So you have people who's coming from the industry they're trying to disrupt, been in the industry for like 5-10 years, have software background or like, you know, being exposed to, you know, more innovative ways of doing things, now taking the destiny into their own hands and trying to solve it. You have people coming from the top academia, academic institutions with the latest studies and trying to implement those things into these traditional industries. You also have tech founders who came from the software world, seeing that there might be a way to replicate the playbook in the climate industries, coming outside in from that angle as well. So I think generally these are the three mainstays of, you know, I guess like channels I see founders from. But of course, there's just so many, given that, again, a theme, not an industry.
Let's pivot to something completely different. Why did you decide to start a fund in this fundraising environment at this time? What led to that?
Well, to answer part of the question, I can't choose the fundraising environment, but I certainly can choose I want to start a fund. We want to start a fund. So I guess like the three of us came together through similar but also very different paths, right? So for Josh and Raj, this is a new chapter to focus on something that they really care about and somewhere they see they can see leveraging their past experience in a way that this sector or this theme of investing might need. Both of them came from founder turning investor backgrounds, right? Started companies, run them, sold them, became investors, and repeat that process for their investment as well. But both of them have like very deep roots when it comes to climate, right? So Raj, for example, was at one of the TED conferences back in the days where Al Gore spoke about the inconvenient truth, right? And he joined the brainstorm session right after that speech and came out with one of the first social media games when it comes to, you know, climate, solving the climate crisis. And that was his first exposure to it. During the pandemic, Josh also worked with the Californian governor when it comes to a public-private partnership, right? Both dealing with COVID and other big, you know, public crises we're facing today, such as climate. So, and then I kind of come from the angle that's like, I first, back in Australia, worked with social enterprises. I was more on the public sector side than, you know, using business solutions to solve the climate issue. Didn't really pan out, and that's how I learned my lesson to focus more on the commercial viability side of things. So the three of us came together in late 2020, early 21, and started angel investing climate, did enough to feel like we should, you know, keep scaling this with the proper fund. Yes, the market environment wasn't the best, but we find that was the right, I suppose, time for us to do it. And one can never wait for the best market environment to start something, so we just went all in.
What were the signals, especially later in your, you know, whether it was angel syndicate investing experience, what led you to be like, this, okay, at this point, I'm sure, let's start a fund?
That's a very good question. Well, I would say that the time that Josh wrote me the offer, but real talk though, I think what was interesting was seeing, I guess, the general societal interest in climate that's getting to the next level. And what that next level means is we are starting to see enterprises piling into the space for business reasons. It's no longer just about, you know, climate activism, which I used to see when I ran my little impact fund at Duke. It's no longer about just like, you know, shareholder activism, but companies are, you know, earmarking budgets, companies are putting down capex because they see this as, you know, not just PR, but also a way to stay competitive in the market and unlock new revenue opportunities. So once you start to see that, you know, you start to feel like there's like multiple years of runway to support a whole generation of startups to be the external brains of these companies to innovate together.
So you're saying, essentially, you're seeing corporate buy-in, you're seeing a real change in behavior in terms of the people are budgeting and allocating money towards this. It makes you feel like there's real potential for companies to get lucrative enough contracts for them to be viable, you know, venture scale companies. In terms of then going out to market and then advertising yourselves as, hey, we're this new, you know, new VC, we weren't in climate before, now we are. When a founder approaches you, what oftentimes are your biggest points of synergy in terms of, you know, this is going well, the founder likes us for this, this, and this, and we like them for this, this, and this? What are the main ways in which like founders really find value out of climate?
By and far, that Josh and Raj came from operator background. They've seen things, but more importantly, they've done things. And now they are able to talk the language of the climate sectors and bridge these two worlds together. No one, I guess, at a climate startup or like a fund usually holds all the keys to all climate problems, right? We're all puzzles, which is why I see a lot of, you know, co-founders rather than solo founders in the space as well. And we're one puzzle to the founders as well. In the case that we can tell you guys, or we can share at least and learn together, how do you run a scalable software power company, which these sectors haven't been seeing as much as in general tech or telecom or other places in the past 20 years. That migration of experience is something that really intrigues, I guess, a lot of founders when we see and, you know, really get the relationships going.
What do you think are the main difficulties right now for founders, especially at the stage you're seeing? What are the biggest things that they're struggling with?
I'll tell a quick anecdote. This is back in Climate Week last year, we hosted a climate tech meets AI competition for startups. And what really intrigued me is I realized the two sides, AI and climate, don't talk. If you ask climate founders what they think about AI, etc., they always think about, you know, what's the next way we can get in front of like the most talented AI engineers and people who've done it, data scientists, etc. It's hard for them to find the right venue to get in front of those folks. Then you flip and talk to like, you know, engineers from Meta or like OpenAI, etc. And they wish they can, you know, oh, you know, this climate founder that's presenting on stage, only if they know this off-the-shelf AI solution that we develop here and there. And only if I knew that there's this field called climate tech and this particular energy niche or like a very, I guess, you know, verticalized opportunity that they're dealing with. So I think what's tough these days is to put your toolkit together and your talent pool together in climate tech when not everybody out there who might be holding keys to scalable software or understanding the policy or, you know, like knowing the enterprise buying power. These people are so scattered around, you know, the community. Getting them together in one room and actually forming a team out of them, I think that's the biggest challenge. But that's also something that we think can be changed with the help of investors and other like-minded people in the field. And that gets us super excited.
What got you to start your T-Series? What was the origin of that?
Ah, this is my soft promo time, isn't it? And precisely because of this, Somil, because the way I thought about this is, think about, imagine selling myself in a competitive landscape of climate events. There's people who's organizing very large events, you know, bringing the globe together to talk about things, right? And then there's, you know, investors and, you know, founders organizing sort of like larger 20-person-ish dinner, right? Where you get people in the same city together. Then there's one-on-one coffee chats and things like that. But then, if you rank that by number of people involved, you're sort of lacking this in the middle part, right? Towards the lower market of like getting people onto the same table, but the table is not too big. So everybody's in the same conversation. And that's honestly how I started, right? Just bring the same, you know, bring one table full of people together. Everybody talk about the same topic that we're interested in. But hey, you get someone like me, you get someone who's, you know, working at a think tank in DC, you get someone who's working in late stage PE and the founder. We're all gonna have very different views, but same topic. And I love tea. So
what's been some of the most memorable conversations from those gatherings? Like, you end up getting these different backgrounds at the table. Do you start with an agenda? Or do you start with a topic to discuss? And how does that usually go?
Very loosely. I mean, the topic goes as far as attracting like-minded people from LinkedIn. And I'll post something like, oh, today we are talking about using AI for automation, or something like, I want to have a group of people who's climate operators in enterprise sales, right? And then you get people together and you talk about things from different angle. And I think the most memorable one I've had, oh gosh, recently, I've had like 30 of them, it's hard to recall sometimes. There was once, I got a bunch of people who's doing sales in climate. And I think that's an interesting one because sometimes people don't focus on the very specific business function that's very generalized, but for climate. Then I have a table of people in different parts of climate. There's carbon credits, there's energy, there's people who are selling to real estate companies. And then it's interesting to see how people, how the sentiment move, right? Like, first people come in, they complain about all different kinds of things they bump into, right? Like doing sales to all these different kind of enterprises. Then they start to realize things that one person's complaint might be another person's inspiration. And they start to give each other advice on how to approach different kinds of companies. And then it got, you know, even more heated when there's back and forth of, oh yeah, that worked in my case, but that didn't. But like, hey, he said about this, but she mentioned that. And then I guess what really amazed me is I can sit back and all I did was serving tea. And everybody left with a whole notebook of like things they might want to implement and try, and like things they want to table because it didn't work somewhere else. That kind of like cross sector, cross rank, and cross, I guess, like even cross, you know, specific role and function exchange of private knowledge is exactly what I love when it comes to early stage investing, pulling knowledge out of people's brains and chuck them into other people's brains.
I feel like that information arbitrage is kind of like currency, essentially, in this industry. So who needs to be at the table more? What general industry, what general type of financing, whatever it is, do you really wish came to your teeth more often?
I reckon two types of people. One is I want people who's at later stage startups, but in, I guess, like specific operational roles, who have firsthand experience interacting with enterprises. I need those feedback points to understand the latest feedback, sentiments, and, you know, just, you know, tell us what's the latest with interacting with big companies. Are they the same as in 2020 or not? That's one group. And the other group I think that should really be at the table are people who's looking outside in into climate. I can never have enough of those people coming from different angles. And most recently, I want to see people who's coming from general tech, people who's like, you know, doing AI, thinking about starting new companies, just expose themselves to maybe climate could be the use case they want to apply their hammers to. I think those are the two groups I'll be most intrigued about.
I get that. I think one of the things that you mentioned was later stage companies, trying to get them at the table. I think that's, you know, a bit of that's an overall market sentiment in terms of the lack of later stage companies in general. A lot of it is what everyone, I guess, sort of in the space has probably woken up to is also the lack of later stage rounds and the lack of later stage deal flow as well. As someone who's investing at the early stages in this context, in this given context, how, because now you're talking about both a lack of information and what we're broadly seeing is a lack of capital. How do you then talk to founders about this and help them engineer their path?
And founders, you mean the founders already in climate tech or founders who's looking outside in, or?
I'd say both, but you know, I think this is specifically to the like companies that you might invest in as they look to grow and scale and get for, like, future rounds of funds.
Now that's a great question. And I think what's interesting is a lot of founders come to us with that confidence and give us a good lecture about what that confidence might, you know, constitute. And one would hope that a founder will have a lot more and very specific confidence than we do in their specific vertical. But not to keep the ball back to you. I mean, my answer to that when it comes to specifically software first investing climate is I think we are riding the first wave of large scale, you know, adoption of software solutions in this space. And it's natural that there hasn't been as many like later stage software solutions in the fields that we're looking at today. So I think it's just a matter of time that it will happen. And we usually will point to earlier generations of climate tech or like adjacent tech or industry applications to see such waves do happen. And we are just in the very early stage of, you know, one of those waves.
You know, speaking of consoling, and again, not perfect segue, we've gone back and forth oftentimes about having to deal with this lifestyle, what it means to be in venture, what it means to be in venture somewhat young in your career and trying to find a path forward. I want to ask you about your experiences there. What was your journey getting into, you know, climate VC, and how are you navigating that lifestyle?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, what's funny is I got asked exactly that question just a few days ago when we hosted a bunch of MBAs from Duke, my alma mater. And the thing is, people get into this space through such different and diverse ways. And I can only share my story. So I mentioned a little bit, I'm from Australia, right? I first started in doing social enterprises with refugee resettlement and the indigenous communities. And that's how I realized I want to do something more focused on, I guess, the financial viability side of things rather than just rely on the government. So by the time I got to Duke, I learned about this new cool thing called impact investing. Well, and then there wasn't an impact investing fund at Duke. So me plus a bunch of like-minded folks at Duke, we're like, why not just start one? So we started like a little angel fund, you know, at a university, got back by the endowment, starting doing things not so dissimilar, to be honest, to the things I do today. It's from that experience, I was like, how do you take this further, but also more specific? Back then I was doing ESG, now I do specifically the E part. Back then it was an angel fund, now I'm doing like an early stage fund. And this during that journey that I met folks like Josh and later on Raj as well. And frankly, I decided to join force with them because I ran with them during our angel investing time for like one and a half years. And I trust these folks. It's for the people that I joined the fund. I think this is, I guess, my story of how to ease into this.
How about its value in terms of a career? When you got into this space, I think one of the interesting things is climate VC is a novel space. It's a question that I'm asking myself a lot, which is, you know, what are the ways in which we want to progress ourselves as individuals? One thing I want to ask you is, you transition into the space pretty soon after, like you mentioned, your impact investing experience, as well as a couple other industry things. Where do you see climate investing going? And do you think the greatest opportunity is in growing yourself as an investor? Or are you looking at something else?
That is such a good question that I spent a whole year last year thinking about. And I would say, I do think it's a huge opportunity. Because as I said before, there's this iteration of like hardware and software going forward. And when you layer on international competition and national security and like national interest, I think it's very sustainable when it comes to the runway of opportunities going forward, you know, decades to come. Now, when it comes to what's the best way to capitalize on these opportunities, I think VC is a great way to do it, because a lot of these opportunities can take, you know, years to mature. And when we want to stay in the game and, you know, continue to ramp up and follow the steps going forward. But certainly it's not the only thing. I do think there's a lot of non-VC, opportunities on the investment side. PE or other, you know, more traditional financing can also have a very good time, because there's so much hardware, installation of such hardware, operation heavy companies that need a lot of help and innovation to deal with this influx of, I guess, like, you know, new ways of doing things and new things getting onto the grid and everything in between. Then there's the operational side, right? Like actually starting a company, capitalizing directly on the wave, which I think there's a lot of know-how to do. A matter of for an individual is in what sequence you want to, or like, you know, in what combination you want to capitalize on these things. And I think at a young age, I mean, I'm the 26, 27 right now, it's good to see what's at the frontier and work your way back from there, understanding the rest of the landscape. But obviously, this is not the only way to do it. I'm very open to other ideas like here and there.
I definitely see that. I think the reason I think it's such an interesting question is because in the climate 2.0, you know, clean tech 2.0 version of the industry is very amorphous in terms of what is the end goal, right? And I think part of that is there aren't as many IPOs. I think the path to getting there is a little bit more frayed. You know, I think people...
Not yet.
You know, I'm anecdotally seeing a lot more exit goals than IPO goals, and I think that really does kind of change a founder's mindset. What are your thoughts on that? Are you still talking in terms of, you know, traditional VC gets IPO, or are you shifting a little bit more towards the exit mentality?
Yeah, that's a very good question as well. I mean, I think it's going to be a blend of both, to be honest, because one big difference between climate tech and the general tech VC we've seen in the past decade is how close-knit it is with the rest of real asset industries, right? Like manufacturing, logistics, etc. And I think part of climate tech will echo VC investing in those spaces too, which, you know, has a lot of acquisitions, bolt-ons, a lot of like those different ways to exit as well. So I think it's going to be more blended compared to traditional SaaS investing, and we keep an eye out for all of it, right? When we do diligence, not only do we look at what the company might be worth in the IPO if they take the market and become a standalone powerhouse, we also look at folks like Schneider or ABB or like large energy companies and whatnot to see potential acquirers, and these people are active in the market. So,
how does that change your perceptive on competitiveness? Especially because I think a big, you know, from when I worked in traditional VC, a big thing you're trying to figure out is how does this company get to, you know, 500 billion, a billion in revenue, right? And that's with the IPO mindset. Now, if you're looking at sort of this blended model, what are the big questions you're asking yourself about companies?
I think, again, just to be super clear, this is not to replace the IPO and moonshot model. I think we need that, right, to make the math work in the current VC model we're functioning on. But I think it just opens up more possibilities for companies that can build to like a very sustainable or competitive size, and then become part of something bigger. And the reverse can also happen, right? Acquire other, you know, competitors in the space and build an ecosystem. And that is also very attractive, given that a lot of these spaces in climate tech are brand new. It's like a, you know, very much a new chapter compared to traditional ways of doing things. So I think it's like both ways, and it just opens up more opportunities than traditional IPO when it comes to returns, when it comes to access or growing the company. The pathway is more varied, I would say.
I see. That definitely makes a lot of sense. I think it's going to be pretty interesting to see what dynamic ends up emerging on the founder side, how founders right. sort of view, I think, getting within this, you know, potentially the financial markets will improve, but at least navigating the current situation. I know we've talked about it in a previous episode, but there is this interesting dynamic and this interesting tension between founders and VCs about exiting early and what that means for both the founder outcome, but also the returns for the fund, and seeing that dynamic play out. It's interesting to see what that does to the overall confidence in climate VC as a whole. So I wanted to ask you that because I think, especially as a new fund, you have an interesting perspective on being fresh in the market, you know, at this time. So I really appreciate that.
And I think, like, again, like, just to add on this a little bit, two more comments. I think one, I know we've been talking about this topic as, you know, climate versus general, but really, I think we are not alone in figuring this out and experiencing this firsthand. Look at our peer investors in, you know, transportation, logistics, and other VC verticals, and stand closer to the real industries, in addition to software. These folks have went through cycles and waves as well, and they also have answers in their own regard too that we can draw from. So that's one thing. And so, Mel, I think another thing that's interesting is like the sequencing we talked about before, this software push hardware push software thing, right? So because of that sequencing, you're also looking at the spacing of between ecosystem function and product, or like, you know, feature great opportunities, right? And then I do think as we draw the timeline longer in the climate investing space, we will see more ecosystem great things coming along, right? Like, we're seeing one or two when it comes to carbon accounting, we're seeing things when it comes to, you know, like carbon credit, but like there's going to be way more of this coming in. And of course, in the middle, you'll have smaller but still very strong opportunities scattered around too. So
I definitely, you mentioned something that I found really interesting. There was a Forbes article that was put out, I believe, towards the end of 2023, and it was I think something like the 12 trends for VC in 2024. And one of the things that mentioned, and I think this is a conversation that's happening writ large, is 2024 will be the year of the hyper specialist VC, which means that LPs more than ever are looking for differentiation. There's sort of like too many funds out there, and there's also sort of this mass extinction, prediction of a mass extinction of funds coming for at least traditional VC. So I think there's a huge, huge premium on funds that have real differentiation. One of the things that I presented as a talking point, and also a conversation with a lot of my peers, is that climate has a unique opportunity in that way. You know, given that the headwinds of climate really continue, climate essentially is a take on general VC investing, where you believe that the differentiator is climate, you know, whether it be the IRA or general momentum, or like you said, changing tastes and behaviors of corporates, is a way of specializing. And what I'm hearing is you kind of think the same way.
Yes, we think the same way. And I think our LPs think the same way, to the extent that we literally made like a 4x4 slide for LPs exactly on this topic back in 2022 when we were pitching. And I think it is interesting, right? Remember this concept of us being a bridge between general tech experience and climate tech possibilities I mentioned before. And then that's exactly what we pitch ourselves for in front of our 60s, 70s LPs. It's not enough to just have the industry knowledge and moat, because that's just looking at what the problems are from those industries and solving those problems using the existing toolkit. So only specialization is not enough. But only VC, as we just talked about, is also not enough, right? Like, when it comes to, you can't just copy-paste stuff from the general tech world into climate, or you can't just like always go outside, and you do need someone on the inside to make it work. But being in the middle and speak both languages, I think that's a very specialist and interesting positioning, especially at an age where some of the investors in the past 2 years, what we call climate tourists, retreated from the climate space. And now suddenly you're left with an opening of software opportunities without as much coverage from the generalist software investors. And that's exactly where we come in and hopefully want to be a powerhouse team.
That's very exciting. You know, before we round out, we're coming up towards the end of the show. One thing I do want to ask, we've talked a lot about founders, their situation, all of those things. I think as someone who's recently broken to VC, I'd love to ask you about your experience being a new and sort of a relatively new entrant into the VC space. How has that adjustment been, especially on you in terms of the way that you strive to be, you know, your best self in VC? What are the kinds of things that you've adopted and advice that you can give to people who are either trying to be great climate VCs or hoping to get into the space?
Yeah, my dude, that's a big question. Look, I would say there are a lot of tough things in the world. And I think being VC and young is both lucky and tough at the same time. I remember back in 2020, I consulted one of my mentors about getting to VC. He was bang turned VC. And he was like, just remember, it's going to be a lonely, lonely job. I was like, how's that going to work? You know, when you talk to people every single day, extroverted, you know, this and that. And it was. And it has been. Work weeks can feel incredibly lonely because the fun works the best when we have each other's backs and we go out to, you know, cover different things, right? So a lot of times I have to function as a lone wolf in a big crowd of people, right? So, and at the same time, the flexibility that comes with that is both a blessing and a curse, right? I can no longer measure my work hours literally as a reflection of my productivity. So there's, you're always in a limbo of you're doing too much, so you feel overwhelmed, or you do too little that, you know, you feel you're, you know, underutilized. And lastly, justifying patience at our age in one's 20s is tough. And no one has the answers to all the big problems that we talk about just now. And it's scary to think about all these things when you're 25, right? How do you anchor that faith and conviction? These are big questions I have to figure out. And I think for those who want to get into VC, I will really want to, I guess, like ask people to reflect on why you want to get into this. Is getting to VC the means or the end, right? For me, it goes more on the means side, in the sense it's a way for me to expose and participate and, you know, roll up my sleeve to do my part when it comes to energy transition and climate tech and decarbonization. And I think this is one way that excites me and I can put in my power to do it. If that's what you're doing for whatever vertical you want to get into in VC, that's awesome and I super encourage that. Then maybe you want to think about, okay, is going straight into VC the best way to do it? This is somewhere I made a very big trade-off because a lot of people get into VC after first-hand startup founding or operational experiences. I don't have that. And someday, maybe in my 30s, there will be people who's like that entering VC after exiting a bunch of startups, right? So how do I, you know, work but also compete with those folks? The big question I have to think about. It might be through like a big public presence and being resourceful. It might be building myself into a brand and a powerhouse in climate to provide more resources and ground it in these industry modes. Who knows? But you kind of have to figure it out on the fly. And that's something, I guess, like a lot of people getting to VC might find interesting to learn about because it's not a linear industry with clear promotion or like way to rise to the top. You kind of have to like, you know, figure out your way because end of the day, money is just greenback, it's commodity. You are the unique asset and you are selling yourself.
So. I love that quote. I think the trade-off of being straight into VC or going from sort of finance or, you know, traditional consulting IB background versus being a founder first, I think that's a dynamic that especially in climate is a little bit of a question because there's so few climate successes or so few yet, right? That I think there's a real premium on successful operating experience. So you really are making that trade-off in saying, okay, let me go for perhaps the more conventional asset, which is transitioning from a traditional role into climate VC. At the same time, then you have to, like you said, become a better asset. So one thing I wanted to ask was, what are some of your better habits that you think are elevating your game in this, given the position that you're in?
Yeah, no, that's a super good question. Well, you mentioned the afternoon tea that I host. I think that's one way to do it. As an example, to build a brand so you can surround people around you, right? I think this theme of investing is still in early stage, that there's just no one playbook of how to surround people, what the combination of people, you know, is the best, right? So my philosophy of what kind of like sort of a community I want to surround myself with and building the community will attract people, hopefully, founders that agree with this is how to build a climate startup. And that's something that I'm building right now, drawing different elements from different parts of the world and making sure that happens. So that's one thing. And with the, I guess, the operational experience, it's not just like one thing I want to spend a lot of time on is portfolio management and helping our portfolio founders how to, you know, take their businesses to the next level, right? And that's also very interesting because not only am I learning, I guess, you know, how to be part of their business and part of the dream that we're building together, it's also empathy, right? Empathy with the founders. On a personal level, the loneliness they went through, right? The, I guess, confusion in productivity or confusion in, you know, the value they're chasing after a prioritization that they went through and understanding that journey, right? To that I can bring to other founders in the space as well. So like bringing these things together, hopefully, right? I can have a personal brand with a unique combination of resources and people that say this is Peter's community. And then also combined with the empathy and grounded in how the way that I can help my portfolio company so that you get both of it if you have me on board as an investor.
Amazing. And I really respect that because I think, you know, it goes to show that it's been working so far. So really appreciate that note. I think really appreciate being able to end on a more personal sort of setting there because I think that is something that we don't really get to talk about all the time because, you know, we're busy talking about people's successes, but it's also worth, you know, recognizing that there's still, you know, nothing is certain. And I think especially in VC, like you're really making a lot of bets. And so you really have to love the process and not just the end product. So
I think so. Yeah. And if I were just going to add one more thing to finish, I think, you know, this like two, 3 years in VC plus another 3 years running the Impact Fund really helped me learn and critically reflect what faith and conviction really mean, right? So in a few like hours, if 10 out of 10 people already believe in it, I mean, there's nothing left for VC, right? If there's only like half of a person believing in it, that's pretty also too early. So, but in the middle, right, what is your tipping point? What is, you know, what is your faith founding on? Is it 3 people agreeing with it? Is it you seeing a contrarian view in it? I think figuring out where you stand and go with it just with faith, I think that's something that I learned a lot, then, which is why I guess I'm still going to stay in this job despite all the questions we went back and forth about the pushbacks and like the early stage and emerging nature of the industry. So understanding and having faith, I think that's a note I want to end on and hopefully share with other people who's interested and curious about climate tech, this field that we're so passionate about.
Well, look, you stayed strong, you debated and you convinced me. So I think you did a pretty good job all in all. Amazing. Where can people find you?
Well, they can find me on LinkedIn. They can also find me on Instagram, but if they want to become my personal friends. And also just stay in tune for any events coming out of Climatic. I host afternoon teas in New York City and San Francisco for all sorts of climate people get together periodically. So just look out for that. And most simply, just send me an email, man, or just like, you know, text me on LinkedIn. I'm always online.
Amazing. I'm going to hit you up for one of those teas. All right. Nice. We appreciate it.
Alrighty. Cool. Thank you.